and welcome to the Eastern Front. My name is Delbert Rohaj, and I'm a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. I'm joined by my friends
Giselle Donnelly. I also work at AEI, and
Yulia Zsozsa with the Middle East Institute, Georgetown, and George Washington Universities.
On our podcast, we talk about the challenges to European peace and security that have erupted along a line running from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea, the Eastern Front, and about why those matter to the United States. Our special guest today is Christian Prick, the ambassador of the Republic of Estonia to the United States. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing, rating, and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Ambassador, it's a great pleasure to have you on the show, partly because of your current role as ambassador to Washington, but also because of your previous roles, particularly with the Defense Ministry, where you served, among other roles, as the permanent secretary. We are less than 2 months away from the NATO summit, and if you are having conversations around Washington about what the U.S. administration has planned for the summit, the answers tend to be quite vague, and they tend to center on celebrating the 75 years of the alliance. Obviously something that is worth celebrating, but there is a shooting war in Europe. There are, you know, sources of instability in NATO's eastern neighborhood. When Estonians discuss the upcoming summit, are they also looking forward to a quiet celebration of NATO's 75 years, or are their expectations higher than that?
Thank you. Thank you for the question, Dalibor, and thank you very much for having me. These are very relevant topics. Estonians certainly are people that also want to celebrate. But then again, when it comes to the NATO summit, we have to make sure that not only can we celebrate the past events, but we take steps that are relevant in this current moment so that our kids and grandkids can ultimately, if not celebrate, then at least not be unhappy about the decisions that we are taking right now. So in this respect, even though the NATO 75 years, as well as the celebration of 25 years of Poland, Hungary, and Czech Republic in NATO, and 20 years of my country and several other countries in NATO, is certainly very pertinent, and we would be happy to raise the glasses for that. And we are absolutely sure that this summit should focus on the current challenges of the European security. And at the moment when we have the largest land war in Europe going on since the Second World War, we definitely have to make sure that the summit deals both with the situation in Ukraine as well as the wider issue of allied deterrence and defense.
So what does your wish list concretely look like for the summit?
With the summit, there is always this risk that different countries or even individual countries come with the wish list that end up being Christmas in July. We rather shouldn't have too many priorities, otherwise nothing is priority. As I pointed out, we need to see that the summit sends a very clear message on the Ukraine issue. We would like to see NATO not just repeating the language that we already know from Bucharest and or from Vilnius, but we have to send a strong message from Vilnius to Washington. There has been progress when it comes to Ukraine's movement towards NATO, and that NATO members collectively want to see Ukraine achieving the membership as soon as possible. Secondly, on the Ukraine piece, we are having debates within the alliance on how to make sure that there is also a strong practical message on the help that NATO members can give to Ukraine today, this year, but also down the road, to make sure that they are successful in their current fight and also ready to deter and defend in the future. And this is where there are many, many moving parts. As you can expect, Estonia is more on the, let's say, ambitious side of the alliance, where we think that both mechanisms on helping Ukraine to move towards membership and while also preparing their future force, so assistance on the interoperability and training and so on and so forth, should be in place, as well as a strong commitment on military assistance to Ukraine. Estonia has publicly not only stated, but our government has decided that at least for the next 4 years, Estonia will commit at least 0.25% of our GDP towards military assistance to Ukraine. We believe that if the entire alliance, all the members, would commit to a similar level of assistance, and let me remind you, this is less than 1 day's worth of our GDP, then Ukraine would have the tools that are necessary to deal with the Russian aggression and to actually win this war. On the defense at the deterrence side, what we are very adamant is that, that NATO moves forward with the work that has been going on for the last couple of years. Vilnius was a place where the family of new defense plans was inaugurated, so to say. We know that we are continuing to work with this, particularly on the capability side, on how to make sure that not only do we have excellent plans, but also that we are dealing with the existing gaps in capabilities, that these gaps get filled hopefully sooner than would have been projected in the recent past.
I wonder if we could also take a step back to provide a little context, and particularly an Estonian view on several things. We have a largely American audience, and their engagement with Eastern Europe has been sporadic at best. But it would be good to remind our listeners of a couple things. First of all, the geopolitical importance of the Baltic Sea, and particularly of Estonia's position there. And secondly, Estonia's experience as a frontline state within NATO. You guys have been perhaps the most shining example, both of your, in the sense of being strategically serious, but also deeply committed to liberalizing your society. So if you could just put our listeners in that sort of a picture, I think that would be a huge help and help them look at the summit in a way that they might not otherwise.
Sure. Estonia is part of, pointed out, Giselle, Estonia is a part of the Baltic Sea region, the northeastern part of Europe, which has been the reason of growth and increase or improvement of democracy for the past 30 years. In fact, I would encourage anyone who might one day doubt whether the Western model of liberal democracy can be relevant and successful in this cruel world to take a look at the experience of the Baltic Sea countries, particularly the experience of Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and Poland since the end of the Cold War. It's been a story of great successes where the countries that found themselves on the ash pile of the Soviet bloc in the early 1990s have now become not only countries that top the ranks of different ease to do business, the freedom of media, the freedom of the society at large, and so on, but also the countries that are net exporters of prosperity and stability and security. Countries that are very strongly pro-American, countries that have been with the U.S. in different military operations and have stood side by side with American troops. Now, why this area is geopolitically important? Estonia is bordering Russia to our east, just as is the case with Finland, with Latvia, and generally speaking, the Russian ally, Belarus, also the case with Lithuania and Poland. We are the frontline countries, as your podcast name suggests. And history has shown us that in Europe, gray areas mean green light for aggression or invasion. Our people have loud and clear chosen to be part of the Western world and have chosen to live in the way that we all live here in the West, have chosen to be strong allies of the United States. If we weren't the member of NATO, I'm afraid that I won't be sitting here as the Estonian ambassador. It's quite possible that we would have fallen prey to the Russian imperialists. At the same time, as I said, this region, the growth in economy and the development of free, liberal, democratic societies have created trade and investment opportunities, have created a zone of stability and prosperity in Europe that actually benefits also the rest of Europe and transatlantic space. So this is the way I see it, and this is why I think that not only has been developments in our region been beneficial to the US and its allies in this region, but these benefits actually go well beyond the Baltic Sea region or Europe.
Ambassador, Baltic-Nordic cooperation has been, prior to the full-scale invasion, already big and sort of a model for the rest of the alliance in terms of regional cooperation and particularly interoperability. And I'm wondering if you can give us the gist of how the security environment has changed, both in terms of cooperation between Baltic and Nordic countries after and in the context of Finland's and Sweden's accession, but also how the security environment has changed due to their accession in the context of Russian aggression. Many of us have followed the news over the last few months with what we call hybrid warfare from Russia increasing, from GPS jamming to critical infrastructure attacks and beyond. Some of it, this is alleged, some of it we're suspecting, is overlapping with Russian interests and Russian action. So would you describe to us the level of interoperability and cooperation when it comes to the Baltic Sea region, or in the context of Sweden's and Finland's accession, but also how or to what extent things have become more difficult because of that?
If I could append a bit to that question too, if you could also just describe the process of improving alliance deterrence in the Baltics, the advancement from the rotational battle groups to now the ambition to have more permanent presence, which I know you've overseen or participated in during your career.
Sure. Thank you for bringing another couple of very relevant questions. To say it in a very short and simple way, the addition of Finland and Sweden to NATO, their countries, their nations' decision to join the alliance, probably the single most important positive development of the Baltic Sea region security since a very long time. What we can say about the interoperability challenges and opportunities, Finland and Sweden for the past few decades have taken very conscious steps to be both politically but particularly when it comes to practical interoperability, the technical side of it, as well as the different issues pertaining to the, you know, planning standard, the way the their own military organization is run. And they've taken very conscious steps to get as close to NATO as possible. After they actually took the decision to become members of NATO, there certainly are different interoperability issues that still need to be taken care of, but there are also issues between the long-time members of NATO. But generally speaking, we could now just, let's say, open new doors, open new channels to coordinate and discuss with them different things that are relevant to planning and execution of a military operation without having to go through major investments or reforms. What in real terms means for us, for example, is that while even before Finland and Sweden were members of NATO, even back then we did conduct different discussions and exercises with the premise of what if in this particular operation, for example, Sweden allows to use its airspace for deployment of cargo or troops. What if Sweden or Finland decides to share with us certain information? But at the same time, there was always this other side. Since they were not bound by treaty commitments, there was always this other side that what if they are not doing it? Which means that actual plans can hardly be built on the what if kind of caveats. At this point, though, we can now do the plans and actually also exercise with the full knowledge of their intent and their capabilities. So I see a very strong net plus in them joining the alliance. Of course, now the alliance also has to take into account in its planning the addition of more than 100 miles of border with Russia that Russia shares with Finland. And there are certainly other issues that I may not even be aware of, may not be able to think of right now. But I certainly think that the technical interoperability part in the case of these countries was and is and will be a smaller challenge than the hurdle of political non-commitment or non-membership in NATO was.
And if I may follow up on this and ask you also about the challenges that Russian aggression and Russian hybrid warfare are posing to Estonia primarily and also to the region as we're looking into the aftermath of Sweden's and Finland's accession. We know that when they announced it, both Sweden and Finland, despite plenty of fears beforehand from different Western experts, little reaction took place in terms of action from the Russian side. But we've also seen over the past few months reports of Russian hybrid methodology, let's call it that, increasing in terms of presence and level of aggression when it comes to countries in the region, and particularly countries that are smaller and more vulnerable being closer to the border. So how do you assess the security environment in the Baltic Sea region over the past few months and going into, of course, the NATO summit in the coming months?
I think one thing that we have to take into account is that whereas we may have our own ideas of who we are and who are our friends and who are our adversaries, we always have to keep in mind that the other parties, particularly also our adversaries, may have their own ideas and their own perceptions. What I mean by that, even though the Swedes and Finns made the decision to join NATO shortly after Russia started its full-scale aggression against Ukraine, and certainly they were strongly also influenced by the Russian statements in late 2021 and the so-called treaty proposals that Russia presented to NATO and the United States in December 2021. It's pretty clear when we look at the pattern of Russian military exercises. Also, anyone who had followed some of their statements and sentiments expressed by their not only politicians but also the different opinion leaders, that Russia had a perception of Finland and Sweden being part of the Western alliance that they didn't consider friendly. So when observing the Russian exercise patterns, for example, we clearly saw that whenever they conducted some operations in the exercises against NATO, there was always the element that involved the Swedes and Finns, because quite clearly in their military planning, Finland and Sweden were already considered as the opposing force. So this is the context, and I would also point out that there have been possible or quite likely Russian hybrid activities, let's say sabotage activities, in Sweden, possibly also in Finland, way before they became the member of NATO. And more recent activities that we have witnessed in Estonia, we made recently an arrest of a group of residents of Estonia, we believe acted by the orders that they had received from one of the Russian services to create, let's say, a perception of lack of safety and instability in Estonian society. Among other things, they vandalized the personal car of our Minister of Interior. Also, they attacked one of the journalists in Estonia. Also, quite recently, we had a case in Lithuania where Alexei Navalny's co-worker or ally who had went to exile to Lithuania was attacked. We've had the arson attack against one warehouse in Great Britain that they have linked to activities of Russian services. And we have several other incidents in Europe. What we can decide from that is that these things are not just coincidences. These things are part of the Russian activities that are aimed against Western interests. They are meant to intimidate our general public, our decision makers, and certainly create fear and divisions or exploit the existing divisions in our society. We don't think there is a, say, silver bullet against this, but it's probably a mix of different tactics. We certainly think, firstly, of course, we should take it seriously and try to see these patterns not only within our own countries, but across the borders, so that our own security services really get the resources to avoid. This is our preferred tactic. We made it as public as possible, and that we also work with other countries' services to make sure that we don't give upper hand to them, but we are able to, via collaboration, avoid, and if these things have already happened, then at least track down and try to take lessons.
Ambassador, it is fair to say that Estonian concerns about Russia, and alongside Latvian, Lithuanian, Polish ones, were long dismissed as, you know, you're being sort of overcome by your historic experience and not really sort of reading reality correctly. I think the full-scale invasion of Ukraine has put some of those criticisms to rest. Yet, it is not that difficult to stumble upon similar criticisms of the more contemporaneous Estonian concerns about Russian ambitions. Specifically, I presume you, like myself, are concerned that if the war in Ukraine goes poorly, Russia's ambitions will be emboldened and that the Baltic states might be next. To which many people in America respond by saying, well, Russian military has already been weakened quite substantially in Ukraine. It will take them years, if not decades, to rebuild, modernize, and get anywhere near the shape needed to take on the military of any NATO country, even a small one. I presume you would not find these kinds of reassurances coming from American realist circles particularly compelling. Could you tell us why not?
Firstly, we have to make sure that when we have the discussion about whether or not something is possible or not, and we have the same frame of reference. So, for example, I've been in different discussions where different people have suggested various timelines for the Russian military's ability to regenerate its capabilities. And I found that I could probably agree with most of that, but only because they are talking about different things. And mostly when we are talking about Russian ability to regenerate the capabilities and potentially create great trouble or pose serious risks to the alliance, we are not talking about the military that would necessarily roll with its tanks to the gates of Lisbon. But even within a more, let's say, limited approach, we certainly see the kind of risks for the alliance that we absolutely cannot ignore. Now, taking a bit more historic approach or looking back to the history, quite possible that we would have heard similar voices, say, in mid to late 1943 about the Red Army being weakened to the point where, if at all, it's able to still survive as a military or as a country, it wouldn't be able to conduct any major operations to west. Of course, I'm very far from trying to direct parallels to the situation of the Second World War. One has to be very, very careful with the historical analogies. But I would still just leave it here and say that there have been other points of history when people may have underestimated the Russian capability to regenerate. They may not have the help of Lend-Lease right now, but they do have help from North Korea, China and Iran. Now, we see that Russia clearly has the intent to continue its aggression in its current form against Ukraine. And we very clearly also see that whether or not they are able to achieve their operational or strategic objectives in Ukraine in the time frame that they consider fit for them, whether or not they do it, their intent to challenge, fundamentally challenge West and upend the existing transatlantic security, and they will take steps that are in accordance with this strategic objective, including political, military, also gray zone activities, economic activities. And we cannot ignore this threat. We have to be ready for them to use military force.
Mr. Ambassador, we're very grateful for how generous you've been with your time. But before we let you go, I would like to ask one piece of advice. Yulia Dalibor and I are about to publish a report prior to the summit setting forth how NATO should set goals for the future. So I'd ask for your recommendation for the sort of one thing that the alliance should try to accomplish in the coming years that would advance the vision of a Europe whole and free.
So we all know the discussion about the spending or burden sharing in general. We all know how 2% has been this sacred number, even though quite often people may not even realize it. Exactly where does it come from or how NATO in general achieves its capability and readiness. So I just think that, and this is my personal view, I just think that within NATO, we should take a moment and look at the actual requirements or actual need of the alliance, taking into account that we really need to change our deterrence posture from the one geared at deterrence by punishment to deterrence by denial. And we should be very honest about what this all means to our resource requirements, what this all means for our societies. I don't know what's the exact number, but I'm more than certain that it's more. And Estonia this year is aiming at 3.2, possibly 3.4% of GDP for defense spending. And I am certain that it's more that we actually need to spend. If we are really serious about taking this deterrence posture to the level of current needs.
I think that's a great, great point on which to wrap up, which reminds me of the piece that just came out in the Atlantic magazine by our friend Elliot Cohen, in which he quotes Henry IV, "Are these things then necessities? Then let us meet them like necessities," which is a piece of advice that should be listened to by policymakers on both sides of the Atlantic. Ambassador Christian Prick, thank you so much for joining us on the Eastern Front.
Thank you all for inviting me and giving me this opportunity to have this very good and fruitful discussion.
From Giselle, Julia and me, thank you all for listening to the Eastern Front, a podcast dedicated to security challenges that have erupted along the line running from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea. You can find more episodes and additional content on our website, ai.org, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please do get in touch with us on Twitter using the hashtag EasternFrontPod, written as one word, and don't forget to sign up for the Eastern Front's newsletter through the link included in the show notes to receive more content from the Eastern Front. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing, rating, and reviewing us. Thank you, and goodbye.